for a yay saying, you know, or opening yay, say, man, yay. You know, I'll tell you, though, ever since we did this thing about the... clear all the throat there. You know, every time I play one note of the Jew's harp, I get 12,000 angry letters and 14,000 letters saying, Groovy, play more. Yeah, well, of course, it all depends. So many people have ears made out of Reynolds wrap. You know, you have problems hearing anything. Unless it's conventional. I think most people are so conditioned throughout their lifetime as to what is music and what isn't music that they're not prepared to accept anything other than that thing, you know? And that that fits everything. That fits styles. It fits cars. It fits baseball players. It fits almost anything that you see in your life. You know, women. You know? Oh, yeah, it's very hard to adjust. If you're stuck there deep in the concrete, let me try this again. Oh, that's great. Oh, I tell you, that's glandular. You agree? Ah, yes, the music of the spheres. Speaking of the music of the spheres, we have a highly literate very, very highly motivated literate-type show here for you tonight. And you don't often do or hear literate-type shows on the air. You know, you just don't. In fact, you know, there was a piece on Billboard here the other day, or Variety, one of the big trade journals. Might be of some interest to you. And they were saying in the piece that people who write fiction, in other words, guys that write a great novel, short story writers, poets, and so on, never get on any of the television talk shows or even on any of the radio interview shows. Nobody interviews them. Do you know that, John? Now, if you write a book on how to lose 20 pounds in 5 minutes, you'll be on every show. Or how to cheat in your taxes. How to get more out of your sex. You'll be on every show. Well, I'll tell you, that's called the Dr. Rubin syndrome. But if you wrote War and Peace, friend, you would not even get near even such a, you know, little minor show as Merv Griffin. You wouldn't even get, they wouldn't even talk to you. No way. Well, I mean, you might as well call it what it is. After all, life is life. You have to, you know, life is too short to shilly-shally around and not say what you really think. Don't you agree? I think most people tend to spend most of their lives hiding under the daybed, hoping that nobody will discover what they really think. And then finally, one day, the big curtain falls on you, and you never told them. And they think you loved everything. Oh, yeah? The pigs, you know what? Can you imagine what it would be if tomorrow they called out a new holiday, National Total Candor Day? One day where you could actually tell the truth about everything. Absolutely, without any fear of retribution. I mean, truth from anything, see? You know, anything. Like, just take a guy. Let's assume a guy's married, see? And he's sitting there in the kitchen. It's morning. He's about to go to work. And it's National Truth Day. And he's a patriotic American. So he believes in, you know, celebrating the various holidays. On Thanksgiving Day, he eats a turkey. On Valentine's Day, he sends a valentine. And on Halloween, he goes out and soaps windows. You know, he celebrates all the various holidays. You've seen people like that, right? So on National Truth Day, he celebrates truth. Yeah? And so here he is at 7 o'clock in the morning, and he's sitting down, and his wife says, good morning. So what was that? She says, good morning, Clarence. Speak for yourself. There's a pregnant pause. You know, he's being truthful. He's not being nasty. He's merely telling you the truth. And she says, see, have you noticed that as soon as you tell the truth, people think you're being nasty right away? See, you're being nasty. So then she says, what's eating you? He says, what was that? What would you say, Bernice? She says, what's eating you? He says, well, you actually. She says, what? He says, well, you asked me what's eating me. It's you. You know, you've been on my back for 29 years. I don't know why the hell I married you. Oh, wow. So at that point, At that point, she says, but we've got to stay together for the kids. He says, why? Hey, what do you mean if them kids? Oh, they are a couple of barnacles hanging around here. Look at that big lot there. 7 feet nine, weighs 270 pounds, and I got to buy him a 10-speed bike. He ought to be carrying me around on his shoulders. You know, truth is going to get you into trouble just all the way down the line. So I would like to suggest National Truth Day. It would be a one hell of a wing-ding of a holiday. Even the president could come on and tell the truth. You know, and I mean, what he really thinks of us. He said, look, you ungrateful louts. Not one of you could even, for 5 minutes, talk to the ambassador for Peru. And you call me a dumba. You couldn't even, you know. Oh, wow. Next thing you know, truth is popping out all over the place. And that would be terrible. Now, actually, let's make the very strong differentiation between truth and candor. Anybody out there got a dictionary, you'll see there's a distinct difference between truth and candor. We generally call candor truth. Has nothing much to do with truth. In other words, to say what you actually feel does not necessarily mean that you feel the truth. Aha! That's the aha. And National Candor Day would be very different from National Truth Day. National Truth Day would be far more troublesome, but National Candor Day would cause more fights. Okay? You know, speaking of National Truth Day, I'm thinking about that. You know, nobody ever... Now, for example, I have written 3 bestsellers, you know, Joe. In God We Trust, All Others Pay Cash, Wanda Hickey's Ninth of Golden Memories, and The Ferrari in the Bedroom. And people just don't interview you about fiction. They simply don't. And when they do, when you're booked on a show to talk about fiction, you know, you've written a book, Wanda Hickey just came out in paperback. I get a call from a guy who says, well, what do you want to talk about? He's booking a show. What do you want to say? Well, I wrote a book, and it took me 3 years to write it, and I thought you might be interested in the book. Well, but wouldn't it be great if we talked about it? What do you think the Mets are going to do next year? I said, what the hell's this got to do with what I did? You know, every like if you get Tolstoy in there and you say, listen, we'd like to ask you about the, we'd like to interview you about the babka. How do you like your babka? Do you like it with a little touch of honey on it, or do you prefer it with almonds? He says, but what about War and Peace? What about the, it doesn't matter. And can you imagine Dostoevsky? He's written a family memoir. And they call him up. They say, listen, is this autobiographical? He says, but I was writing about the Russian people. I was writing about the whole panoply of the Russians. And he says, yes, but actually, did you have a brother like that? We'd like to talk about your mother. She's great in that story. But it was not really specifically my mother. That was all of Mother Russia. No way. Can you imagine him trying to handle Mike Douglas? First thing they'd ask Dostoevsky, I could see Mike Douglas, his agent on the phone, say, well, Mr. Dostoevsky, you know, Mike has this thing they call the weekly host, a co-host. Now, he has... For example, there's Dennis Weaver on. Dennis Weaver sings and he tap dances and all that kind of stuff. And we'd like to have you as a co-host. What can you do? But I am the... I can tell the great tales of Russia. I can speak of the whole panoply of Western civilization and of its great impact upon Eastern civilization and the wars and all the... Oh, no, wait a minute, Fyodor. Now, just a minute now. We understand that you do all those things, but do you play the violin? Now, most of the, how about the balalaika? Do you play the balalaika? But the balalaika is only, it's played only by the peasants, and I do have one thing in the book, where the peasants sing and dance, and Nastasha says, how's the balalaika? He says, no, not your book. We don't want to talk about that, please. Do you tell any Russian jokes? You got any Russian funnies? You know, like Polish jokes, you have any Russian jokes? But I can say the Russian joke. Yes, one time the criminal was walking down to... Oh, but that's another thing. It's a long story. you know, can you imagine some of the greats of the past appearing as guests on the various shows was just impossible. Can you imagine, for example, Jonathan Swift appearing on Comedy Night with you know, great comics being interviewed by, say, David Susskind, who has absolutely no sense of humor whatsoever. David Susskind's typical question of a humorist, and I speak as a working humorist, would be, would you please tell us what the influence of the early 19th century satirist has, what it has caused with the general decline of morality in the Western... Oh, my God almighty. There's a laugh a minute there. So anyway, this is a problem that one has to face, and you either face it or not. Can you imagine, hey, by the way, speaking of great great confrontations, really great to see, let's say, to see a face-to-face interview. You know how they have these long fireside chats where Walter Cronkite talks to the president. You know, you've seen these on TV long, and they advertise them for weeks. Can you imagine Walter Cronkite having a face-to-face talk with, let's just say for argument's sake, Voltaire. You ever heard of Voltaire? You haven't. We invented the volt. Ah, I knew you'd understand that. Yes. You can see we have yes. Now I give you something to hang on to, Joe. He invented the volt. The volt is named after Voltaire. High voltage. Shocks, electricity. Would you please give us an American Motors commercial, please?
Your AMC dealers got the all-new midsize car that economizes on everything but comfort. That car, the roomy 74 Matador. And another important advantage. Our 74 Matador comes with an economical six-cylinder engine as standard equipment. And consider this. Matador is the only new midsize car backed by all the benefits of the exclusive AMC Buyer Protection Plan. Which means that under normal usage and accepting tires, if anything AMC did goes wrong with your new 74 Matador in the first 12 months or 12,000 miles, we'll fix or replace it free. Come in today. Meet the unbeatable combination. 74 Matador backed by the AMC Buyer Protection Plan.
I know, Jerry. Don't worry. I prefer to do it with a little dignity. See your AMC dealer where you get a good deal and a good deal more. Okay? He always thinks I forget it. Well, all right. That's all right. All right, George. By the way, speaking of sticky wickets, I think we're... that reminds me, this is WOR New York. Yes, sir, a vandal gave a furniture factory a... Reading this, it sickens me. A vandal gave a furniture factory a very sticky wicket in Great Yarmouth, England. He pulled a plug on a storage tank and flooded the entire factory with a sea of glue. Production stopped, and workers came running out and attacked the gook with shovels and water hoses, which made it even harder. Officials of the Testa Furniture Plant now say the entire plant is glued together, including two foremen. And this is, they are investigating. That's terrible. Wow, you know, I this is so, you know, the downfall of the Western man. That's it. It's all part of it. Everything's falling apart. England, France, America, the whole works. You know, all on the subject of that, that whole business of writers being interviewed on TV and radio, that according to the Variety or Billboard, there is only one show in all of America that actually talks about fiction on a national basis, and that's a show that comes out of Chicago, not New York. Did you know that? Yep. It's Bookworld. Bob Cromie. He's on, naturally, non-commercial television. Have you ever had the vague feeling that we are growing an entire nation of total illiterates? You know, whose idea of real historical American created characters are howdy doody. You know? And I'm very serious about that. I'm amazed at the number of people who have, you know, advanced degrees in literature and one thing or another, who have rarely read anything except the most accepted of American writing. And it's the way it's going. It's part of our time. This of course is not new. There have been periods of great curious cultural illiteracy in the past. I'm talking about over the past 2,000-3,000 years, where there are periods where all of mankind suddenly decides that the only thing that's important is a yo-yo, and they'll start yo-yoing for about 600 or 700 years, and everybody runs around in yo-yos. And then it slowly comes back, and the mind starts working again. But I'm just, I'm just constantly amazed at the number of people who simply do not read, just don't read. And I wonder if they learn to read well in school. It's just a question. Do people who don't read know how to read, actually physically know how to read? Or is it hard for them to do it? Is reading hard? That's a question I'm asking, a rhetorical question. And in short, to many people who are otherwise widely educated, is the actual act of reading and visualizing something from the printed page, is that a difficult process? Is it laborious to them? I don't know. Because, you know, it's been so natural to me from the time I was a kid. I can't remember not knowing how to read. I simply can't remember learning to read. And from the time I was a little kid, and I guess many, many people are like that. I'm sure that most of the people who are listening always knew how to read. But I'm surprised, though, to run into people who I would ordinarily think would read and who are fairly knowledgeable about what's been written, have very little understanding nor interest in anything that has been written. I wonder what they think all those libraries are for. Studying, as they call it? Is that what it's for, studying? Well, what do they think people are studying? Math in those libraries? What? History? I see. Well, all right, if you think it's all history, then how much of that do you read? None. The average American, I think, has problems even... Because you see all kinds of curious confusions about time in various shows on television, for example, that are supposed to be about historical things. And you realize that they're totally confused. That even their researchers go out and superficially will research something. So it's not at all unusual to see a two-hour documentary on warfare, we'll say, on the Channel 2, we'll say CBS, and they'll show a big war between Charlemagne and one of his enemies, and biplanes are flying over. This is constantly happening in various so-called serious attempts to create a pastime. You see it constantly in movies. They're always doing things like that. For example, now, did you see the movie The Way We Were? Classic example of that. They spent the endless amounts of money, apparently, trying to recreate the period with Barbra Streisand and Robert Redford. And yet, the way Robert Redford was, the way he wore his hair, for example, was totally out of character of people of that period. Completely. Completely. And yet her hair was in period. I couldn't figure it out. This is one of those problems. And they'll use words like totally contemporary words that have nothing whatsoever to do with past time. Like the other day, I was watching True Grit. Have you ever seen that? They keep using phrases that have nothing to do with that period, which was in the mid-1800s, or the late 1800s, about 1870, I presume, that movie sort of supposed to have taken place, the Indian Territory and all that. And one of the words she used, or somebody used in there, was, he's all messed up. That's a contemporary phrase. Nobody would use that in 1870. They would say, what do you mean by mess up? Because a mess in those days was something the dog did on the floor. They never referred to your mind in terms of being messed up. That was something else entirely. All these badly used analogies and words often come from total ignorance of times and places. You know, speaking of literary things, I have a literary note to make here tonight. Very important literary note. Do you recall one of the first times? I think many people's minds are never awakened, really, I suppose you might say the sensory things around you. The only thing that most guys think of in terms of sensual are drinking women. That's about it. But the sensuality of the world itself, just the way the sky looks and the way the light hits the hills, the way the water looks, the way the air smells, and the way the sound of a foot hits the ground. This is all sensual, extremely sensual. And I think most people have never really, most people are not awakened to that side of their capabilities, their body. And this is what literature can do to you. Now, I think many people have never been opened up, the windows of their mind have never opened up to the world that they live in. You know, there's a lot of philosophical names for that phenomena. And without using any of those names, it appears in many different religions even, the awakened and the unawakened. The awakened are different from the unawakened, and the unawakened are never aware of the fact that they aren't. They really aren't. And they believe that from what I've seen of them, they believe that when they run into somebody who is aware of all the sensuality of the world and the curious paradoxes and contradictions and ironies and all that he's some kind of a nut. You know, he's some kind of a nut. And so there's a great gulf between the awakened and the unawakened. And I'll never forget, I actually remember when I was awakened to the sensuality of the world. I was about in, I would say, roughly seventh grade. In fact, I know I was in seventh grade. I can remember actually the teacher who was involved in it was seventh grade. I had a teacher named Miss Beverly Smith. She always insisted that you call her full name. She did not like to be called Miss Smith. Because, you know, there's a million Miss Smiths. She was Miss Beverly Smith. And Miss Beverly Smith was a short, kind of a compact lady. She was built a little bit like Fran Tarkenton. You know what I mean? She was well-knit. You have a feeling that she could have taken a lot of buffeting from NFL linemen and never gotten injured. Good scrambler. And there was Miss Beverly Smith, and she was not, you know, she was not. There were many different kinds of teachers you have in your life. You have some kind of teachers that give long speeches constantly in class and that are very boring. You have other kind of teachers that are constantly nagging. Then you have other teachers who are totally inept. I can remember I had one teacher who one time the whole classroom discipline broke down about 3 days into the class. We were about in fourth grade. And when one kid, Farkas, a great moment in class where Farkas had a pencil, and he was sitting about halfway back on a row right next to the windows, and Farkas had a yellow pencil, see, and he's going like this while the teacher is talking. She's up there. She had one of these droning voices going on, which on like this, and she's talking to the boys and girls, and one of those people who you can hardly hear past the third or fourth seat. And she didn't even write well on the board. She makes little tiny writing. You could hardly see it. And there's certain people who, you know, just like that. And she was a nice lady, but she's struggling around it. And Farkas is going like this. He's banging his pen. chance, we'll see. And of course, it was just echoing around the room. He just go like that. And finally, she says, will you stop that? He just goes. He just keeps right going. That was a test. Dramatic moment. She says, would you please stop that? And I say, stop that right this minute. What is your name? You say, Farkas. All right, Miss Farkas, will you please stop that pencil? We can't hear a thing here in the class. You say, make me. Well, at that point, she tried to go on and ignore him. Well, obviously, now the entire class is watching Farkas and not watching the teacher, right? And Farkas is just sitting there. He's got this shock of kind of blondish, red, crummy-looking badger-colored hair. You know, he was a human badger. See, Farkas was, man. So he's going to... He takes his knuckles and he's popping away. See, and at that point, it was, you know, are you going to do anything about it, baby? He is saying. 3 days into the class, this happened. We had just begun under this teaching. This was the first test of power. Now, what could she and should she have done? Well. It's not easy to answer because some people can get away with things that other people can't. You agree? Some people can walk back there and grab Farkas right by the back of the neck, shake him until his teeth rattle, and that's all. The problem is over for the semester. Other teachers trying that would get a kick in the groin. So nobody knows what to do. And she is going, she's working. And so that's what you can hear. He's popping away with a pencil. And finally, she turns to him and says, now you stop that. And there was something in her voice. She was retreating. And immediately, the entire class started. Jack Morton took a paper clip and inserted it in the rubber band and went, zap! He winged it over towards Joshua. And that was the end of the class for that year. She was D-U-N, done. It wasn't 2 weeks later that in the middle of a big hassle going on in class, she started to cry and left the classroom. And we never saw her again. A large lady named Miss Nelson walked in, and Miss Nelson, within 30 seconds, like a gigantic sickle, had cleaned out all the hogwash. We were straightened up, and there was not another sound for the entire semester. And incidentally, Miss Nelson was half the size of the first teacher. There was something, that she radiated something. And that radiation, it was a series of magnetic waves that said, you mess with me, kid. And you are in big trouble. Trouble, spelled with a capital T. And I'm the one that can do it. You hear that? T. Trouble. So this is the way it goes. Anyway, Miss Beverly Smith, one afternoon, was giving out book assignments for book reviews. You recall that? They were all, you know, she was handing out book reviews, you know, stuff like Ivanhoe, stuff like Silas Marner. And she said that, she says, for the rest of you, she says, for the rest of you, she said, I'm going to give you an additional book list, she said, and I'd like to underscore a couple of books that if you take them out, you may find them really interesting, children, boys and girls. And she gave me this book. Well, everybody else got this supplemental list. Now, most of the kids, you know, just stuck them away to hell with it, you know. They were going to cheat on their book review anyway. But I love reading. So I took the supplemental book review, the supplemental book list, down to the library. We had this library. See, and I walked into the library and I said, Mrs. Easter, may I have this book? We had this library. Mrs. Easter, may I have the book? She said, let me see that. They're telling you that you can read this in school? And I said, yes, there's my book list. She said, well, We don't ordinarily give that to children. That's what Miss Smith said. I could read it. It's right there on the list. Well, I don't know what they're teaching these days at these schools. If it's all right with Miss Smith, it's all right with me, but I certainly think that your mother should know what you're reading. Well, at that point, wow, you know, I thought, oh, my God, it's fantastic. And so she gives me this great big thick book from the adult section. I mean, it was the biggest, thickest, fattest book I ever saw. And I took this book back, and I sat down in the library, and I started to read it. At first, it was very difficult, because it was nothing at all like Ivanhoe and Lady the Lake. And all of a sudden, as I read, I could see the sun coming in through the Venetian blinds. And I'm gone. The sun is quietly moving like a golden finger along the floor of time. I've never read anything like this before. I could see the leaves on the hills. Hills I had never even known existed. I could smell the fall air. And down below the town, the river moved along like some great, vast, prehistoric monster. And a curtain was going up in my mind, creaking. And the show was about to begin. Organ was playing somewhere. And the words rolled on and on and on and on. It wasn't that they made sense or not sense. It was that they were beautiful. Great crashing waves of words rolling over the rocks. I could not understand why Mrs. Easter said they didn't give this to kids. The one group they should have given it to was kids. Fantastic. And that great river flowed on. The web of life. The unsung, untold, unopened doors. The stones. A leaf drop. And from that minute on, I realized that there was nothing ever in this world as more, as even remotely powerful than words. Words are what it's about. It's the one thing that makes us different from the giraffes and the turtles. And this writer played upon the mind and upon the language of some demented, fantastically talented, insane dancer on the keyboard of an incredible windpipe organ. But the gods of the stars. Tom-toms beating in the distance. remembered the name of the book.
Always, forever.
He spoke of a stone angel that stood pointing skyward, holding a stone wreath, the wind blowing over its stone arms past its nose. Look homeward. Look homeward, angel. You can't go home again. The wind and the rock. Yeah, did you ever read any of those? Look homeward, angel. Now, who I'm talking about here is Thomas Wolfe, the original Thomas Wolfe, the real one. And the only reason I brought all this up tonight is, you know, I have to say that that one book, I didn't understand anything. I didn't know what he was, you know, what it was about. I think really great literature, you don't have to understand what it's about. You feel it like music. It's a felt thing. And here I was about, what, how old are you when you're in seventh grade? And this fantastic, how old? About 10 or 12. No, I don't think so, because I graduated from grade school at 12. I was about 10 or 11. And we graduated in eighth grade, so I had to be younger than that. So anyway, I was about 10 or 11, and it was a fantastic trauma. It really was. And I remember taking this book home and reading it under the covers at home, because we had this rule, you had to go to bed at a certain time. And I had a pen light, which my Aunt Gwen had given to me for my birthday. You know, this little fountain pen-shaped flashlight. It was a pen light, see? So I was hiding under the covers reading Look Homeward, Angel. And I didn't know what it was about. I just knew I couldn't stop reading it. And it changed me forever, really. I specifically remember Gant, Eugene Gant, and Ben, The Death of Ben. For any of you who've ever read this thing, you know it's unforgettable. But here is what I would like to for those of you who are literary types, and this is why it's great to read the newspapers from all over the country. Here is a news note. Give me, you got that reset in there, Joe? Here's a news note from the Asheville paper, Asheville, North Carolina. This is incidentally what Wolf wrote about. He wrote about Asheville. And here's a news note that just came to me from one of my spies. He says, Shepard, I think you ought to know what's happening down in Asheville. You probably once read Thomas Wolfe. Listen to this. The title is The Angel is Back. Wolfe's Angel is what they call it. She went back up on her pedestal yesterday in Hendersonville's Oakdale Cemetery after a month and a half of repairs to wings and hand. In fact, she's better than a month ago, for city workmen fashioned a new finger star for her head, and they reset a broken hand that was broken years ago. Thomas Wolfe, one of America's great authors, made his angel famous when he wrote his great novel, Look Homeward, Angel. Wolfe, a native of Asheville and graduate of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill, described the angel in his father's stonecutter shop on Park Square, the very same angel that has stood in Hendersonville's Oakdale Cemetery as a headstone for Margaret E. Johnson since her death in 1905. The angel was carved by his father, Wolfe's father, in the novel he was called W.O. Gant. W.O. Gant, for those of you who remember Gant, he was a fantastic character. Carving great stone angels and shaking his fists at the heavens. Oh, God, what have I done to deserve this? What have I done to live in such a world of wanderers and idiots? W.O. Gant. The people of Henderson County are pleased that the angel has been restored after an admirer of Wolfe's writing, David Lubin, 22, of Columbus, Ohio, gave the statue, quote, a caress, and it toppled over, breaking an arm and breaking a halo on the head. The fallen angel was taken to the city's shop for repairs. Earlier, it was decided to have experts from Georgia work on the Italian marble statue. But they finally did it in their own shops by North Carolina workmen, which is the way W.O. Gant would have wanted it. The men fell to the task eagerly. L.Z. Fernandez of 913 6th Avenue West found a piece of white rock in a cemetery that matched the marble, and then with long care and love fashioned a new index finger for the angel. The finger has been missing for many years. He also made new points for the star on her head. Lewis Taylor of Horseshoe, Donald Pridmore of Blythe Street, aided Jones in drilling the pins. That hand had been repaired many years ago, Jones said, but it was not on right, so we redid it. It's beautiful now. Thomas Wolfe would have been proud of it. And now the great angel is standing, pointing to the sky, just the way it did in Thomas Wolfe's great novel. We think Tom somewhere feels good about it. Look homeward, angel. Remembrance about the lady who bought the angel. Her name was Aunt Sally. And Aunt Sally bought the angel to put on her aunt's grave back in 1905. And they said that Aunt Sally, and we'll quote here, Aunt Sally often remarked that she had more money than sense to pay $1,000 for a stone angel carved right here in Asheville, of all places. She could have gotten an Italian one for that. Not many people have an angel carved by W.O. Gant, the angel. Much like, a little like having the poop deck of the Pequod. Oh, look homeward, angel. Oh, lost, oh, gone. I'd just like to... I'm making a prediction right now. I think that within not too long, people are going to... There's going to be a re-evaluation of this fantastic writer, but on entirely different grounds for the sheer, unbelievable, enormous musicality of what he wrote. He wrote like Beethoven, you know, great chords, fantastic sounds and words, and the smell of the river, and the trains going through the October countryside. K-19, the name of the car, that great Pullman car of time, rolling through the eternal hills, and the angel could not go home again. And the web and the rock rode on down the road. This is WOR New York. Stay tuned for John Wingate in the news.